On Earth Eats, Chef Daniel Orr is prepping for a day of beets.
We cook them here in our stone oven. We put a sheet tray with a bunch of kosher salt and then kind of rest those beets on top of the salt bed so they don't burn on the bottom.
That's his favorite way to prepare beets. He also steams some golden beets for us. Stay tuned to see what comes next in these recipes. I'm Annie Corrigan. Welcome. Farmers have found a way to cash in big on their old wooden barns. That story from Harvest Public Media. Then,
the hardest part of running a business should be selling what you make, not the brick and mortar that you're working out of.
We learned about a project in Colorado that's calling itself the Airbnb of commercial kitchens, and tips and tricks from caterer Corbin Morwick. Food news of the week, here's Mark Chilla.
The nation's first soda tax on sugar-sweetened beverages, which went into effect in Berkeley, California last year, appears to be working. It taxes sugary drinks at the rate of 1 cent per fluid ounce. According to a new study, consumption of sugary drinks in some neighborhoods is down 20%. Researchers began laying the groundwork in fall 2014 for efforts to measure whether such a tax would actually work. They asked people on the street how much of which beverages they drank. After the tax passed in Berkeley, researchers went back to the same areas to ask residents the same questions. That's how researchers calculated the 20% drop. Christine Madsen of the University of California Berkeley School of Public Health says that reduction in consumption of sugar-sweetened beverages would be enough to reduce rates of obesity and type 2 diabetes in years to come. But she's not sure it will be sustained. People may be more inclined to react to such attacks when it is new. The study was published in the American Journal of Public Health. The U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee wants to examine proposed mergers among agricultural chemical and seed companies. Chinese chemical giant ChemChina is in talks to buy Syngenta. Dow and DuPont are also hoping to combine. Among the few remaining large companies, several possible deals involving Monsanto have emerged. All of this has led regulators and lawmakers to worry about decreased competition and higher prices for farmers. Iowa Republican Senator Chuck Grassley says the Judiciary Committee will hold hearings to add oversight to Justice Department and Federal Trade Commission reviews. The Committee on Foreign Investment in the U.S. cleared ChemChina's bid for Syngenta of national security concerns earlier this week. On a Midwest trip this week, the U.S. Agriculture Secretary offered advice to the next presidential administration. Harvest Public Media's Amy Mayer has more.
Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack has been on the job since 2009, and in that time, his department has expanded programs for local foods and farmers markets, school meals and nutrition, and rural development. He noted that soon the agricultural sector will begin work on the next farm bill, which covers everything from crop safety nets to the food stamp program.
The next agriculture secretary needs to have a very broad understanding of what this department does, who it impacts, and that it has an impact and effect on every single American, not just Americans in one part of the country or growing one type of commodity.
In Ames, Iowa, Vilsack urged a group of young farmers to keep explaining the food system to the public and to push together for what they need in the next farm bill. Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
And USDA researchers have come up with a new wrapping that's edible and biodegradable, made from milk. Well, not milk exactly, but casein, a protein found in milk. The researchers added glycerol, water, and citrus pectin to casein powder to create the new product. Turns out, casein is better at protecting your food, too. It's almost 500 times as effective as plastic at preventing spoilage because proteins like casein form a tighter network when polymerized. Because it's also less sensitive to light, casein is more effective than edible wrappers made from starch. While you could just peel off the casein wrapper and eat it, you probably won't have to. It will likely come in the form of a dissolving packet that actually adds protein to your meal. It may also appear in cereals as a sugar-free crunch preserver or in pizza boxes as a lining alternative to the now banned perfluorinated chemicals. Although it may be many years before USDA researchers make casein wrapping available. Thanks to Dan Charles, Taylor Killow, and Amy Mayer for the reporting. Read more from them at eartheats.org.
And a big thanks to the voice of our news, Mark Chilla.
It's my pleasure.
on HGTV or DIY Network and you're bound to see someone asking for reclaimed barn wood. The business of deconstructing old barns and selling the wood for fancy new homes and condos is booming. But is it causing the loss of an iconic element of farm country? Harvest Public Media's Christopher Husted digs in.
Old barn wood is called a lot of things in the construction business. Reclaimed, salvaged, repurposed. And it's so hot right now that it has its own show.
This is why we got in the business, to see how the pioneers lived.
And a true love for what they do. Catch an all-new Barnwood Builders, Sunday night at 9.
My name is Mark Bowe, and I'm the host of DIY show Barnwood Builders.
For 20 years, Bowe has been taking old barns apart. He says his customers are interested in what's called upcycling, taking undesirable or waste materials and creatively reusing them, turning barn siding into brewery bars or restaurant tables.
Most people want the accent pieces. You know, they want to have those pretty beams in the ceiling, or they want to have, you know, the barnwood walls or the tables and the furniture.
Bo says we're in the midst of a barnwood frenzy right now, but it can't go on forever. There are only so many weathered barns in the U.S.
And this is a finite resource, so it seems like every building we take down, we deplete our livelihood.
That's the trade-off. With every barn that comes down, the classic landscape of American farmland littered with wooden barns fades away. Danae Peckler is trying to make sure that doesn't happen. She's an architectural historian with the National Barn Alliance.
Preservation in the past has really sought to preserve the great grand mansions of important white men, but we are so far beyond that now as a discipline, and we start to look at average individual landscapes that really tell the American story, and the farm is one of those.
For farmers, many of these aging barns have lost their purpose. They can't fit today's giant tractors and are too small to house the larger herds of cattle or hogs. Peckler says she understands the big changes, but she hopes people at least take photos and write down the barn's history before salvaging it for parts.
It makes me a little sad, but it also makes me a little excited. It makes me think that at least we're recognizing that this has some cultural resonance with us, and we find that rustic elements of a barn.
It's a beautiful morning.
Larry Gertis is having a barn taken down today in central Missouri. It's about the size of a three-car garage, but stands much taller in a clearing surrounded by 6-foot stalks of corn. Its exterior is graying, part of its roof is missing, and there's a gaping hole looking out from the hayloft. He figures the barn is about 100 years old.
Well, the reason it's time to take it down is it's deteriorated and it would cost a lot of money to repair it, and it doesn't fit into the modern farming. Unless you got 2 cows to let them loaf inside, nothing fits, and it's just obsolete.
So who gets to take it down? Mike Hudson. He runs a business that deconstructs dilapidated barns and sells the pieces to contractors and designers. And while he'd offer to take your barn off your hands for free, he has paid up to $1,000 for one.
These were built with a lot of 2x6s, a lot of 2x4s. Everything's rough sawn for the roof truss, and that all looks to be oak.
Hudson says it costs him about $500 a day to pull apart a barn by hand using hammers and crowbars. This barn will take 2 weeks.
This is it. This is what I have a passion for. And if you can find that passion, that's what you stick with. It's not always about the money.
The weather vane will stay with the Gertis family, but the rest of it will go to Hudson's lumberyard. In the end, he'll sell the wood for between $5 to $10 a square foot, depending on species, size, and condition. Hudson says he has an immense respect for the crafting and history of old barns. He takes photos to share with the owners and always asks about the history of the farm.
That's the thing that we take into consideration when we come in, because we're just as passionate about bringing it down properly, respectfully, as the pioneers were back then to build it.
A few years ago, many farmers didn't understand how valuable their old barns were and might have been swindled, Hudson says. But today, they know the capital they're sitting on. Enriched in history, and in turn, money. Christopher Husted, Harvest Public Media.
See the photos that go with this story at eartheats.org. I love beets. They are my favorite of all the vegetables. So this is, maybe it's for me. Did you do this just for me?
Well, I think you put it on the list of things you wanted to do. So I don't know if you did it just for you or you did it for your listeners.
But busted.
We're going to do it anyhow.
I'll admit it, I bumped this to the top of the list. Fellow beat lovers who responded to our Twitter call out, this is for you.
Today, we're using a lesser known beat, which is a golden beat. They are a little less earthy. A lot of people complain to me that they don't like beats because they taste like dirt. But I think that the golden beets are a little less that way. You can also get white beets and candy cane beets, which when you cut them, they'll be white and red on the inside. And those are really nice to use raw, sliced real, real thin over a salad. And they've got that kind of sweet, earthy flavor to them. The golden beets I do several different things with. These over here, this is the raw one, which you can see is very, very yellow. And then once you steam them, and we steam them for about 45 minutes, you'll see till you can stick a knife in it and it pulls out easily. So if it has any resistance and the knife kind of tugs, the beet tugs at the knife, it's not ready. You really want to cook it till the knife slips out. There's several other different ways you can cook beets. You can roast them. We cook them here in our stone oven. We put a sheet tray with a bunch of kosher salt and then kind of rest those beets on top of the salt bed so they don't burn on the bottom. Kind of lifts them off the bottom of the oven. And then they roast. And that way they actually dehydrate a little bit and they get a very intense sweet flavor. Back in the old days, they would have the village bread oven heated up, and you'd cook your bread when the oven was hot, and then you would throw your other things like your beets and your pumpkins and your chickens in to catch the residual heat from the wood oven, so that all the villagers would bring their dishes down and cook them all in one oven. So I think that, you know, I mean, those are kind of nice old days, but I probably wouldn't want to have lived in them anyhow.
This recipe, you guys, I am so eager to share it. It's pickled beets and some garlic and ginger and a cinnamon stick. No pressure canner necessary. Take it away, chef.
We're just going to make a vinegar and honey brine and pour it over the top and then just keep them in the fridge. So these won't be shelf stable. You'll have to refrigerate them. We're going to take the beet and we're going to dice it. You can cut it in any shape. You could leave them as kind of rectangles or fingers as well. That actually might be nice. I think that looks pretty like that. All right, so I'm going to grab a pot and I'm going to show you how to make this vinegar bath. So I'm going to throw a couple of these Thai bird peppers in there. You could put a habanero in there or whatever you like. I'm going to add about a cup of water, a half cup of cider vinegar, honey. We've got about a quarter cup of honey, about a tablespoon of sugar. We're going to mash a couple cloves of garlic. Just throw in a couple more things. We've got a oregano sprig and a little bit of rosemary. I'm going to throw in a couple little baby sweet red peppers just for color.
Bring that to one boil.
I'm just going to pull out those little bird chilies, my cinnamon stick. Oh, that vinegar got me. Then we're going to pour this ginger vinegar over the top, fill it all the way up, and we seal it tight. And then what my grandma always did, she turned them over and left them on the counter like that to cool. And that's all she wrote.
Did you ever ask your grandmother why the heck she flipped it over like that?
It would hold the seal. And also the herbs and stuff would give their flavors and have it go up.
Smart lady.
Yeah.
These will stay good in the fridge for up to 3 weeks. Daniel talked about how to roast beets. Well, he has a bunch of those to combine with fennel, pears, and onions just ahead. Then we spend some time in caterer Corbin Morwick's kitchen. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated. Now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington, independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. And from Urgent Foods, a locally owned food truck offering gourmet choices for all lifestyles, tastes, and diets. From vegetarian to paleo and low carb, taste matters, your taste. Current truck location is available at whereisurgent.com. I'm Annie Corrigan in beautiful Bloomington, Indiana. Chef Daniel Orr grew up about 40 miles east of here. He gardened his whole life, and he still spends a lot of time with his hands in the dirt. So, tips and tricks for getting a good beet crop?
Well, always plant more seeds than you're going to need, and then you can thin them as they grow. And that way you can use those nice tender beet greens in dishes, and you can make sure that you have a full row. Medium water, don't overwater them. Nice, nutritious, and sandy soil. Sandy soil is going to be good for any root vegetable, carrots, beets. Often I'll just put some sand down the middle of a row, underneath the beet seeds or carrot seeds, just so they can break through. Otherwise, you'll get these gnarled little roots that aren't very attractive, and then, it's kind of discouraging. So try to find your loosest, kind of most aerated soil for root vegetables.
Okay, in the kitchen now, the only thing to be intimidated by when it comes to these root veggies is how long it takes for them to cook. In an oven, you'll need 45 minutes to an hour, but it's worth it over other cooking methods because roasted beets are sweeter and more intensely flavored.
So I'm going to take the beet, and what I did was after they were tender, I put them in a plastic container, covered them so they would steam, and then they are really easy to peel. Okay, so I'm going to grab about three of these, cut these in what we would call in France bâtonnets, which means small batons or small sticks. And I like this cut for beets. Okay, and I have that nice crunchy Bosque pear to play off the beets. Then we're going to use fennel. It's a bulb eaten raw a lot in Italy, in salads, and great with things like prosciutto and Parmesan cheese. I usually take out the most exterior layer, and I can save that for soups and stocks. Then I cut the tender bulb into thin slices. Okay, red onion, very, very thin. Again, building those flavors and those textures. Okay, then we've got feta cheese. And the feta is nice and salty, so we aren't going to need to put a whole lot of salt in this dish. All right, and then what's our favorite salad dressing?
Olive oil and lemon juice.
There we go. Simple, fresh, letting the ingredients speak for themselves. Okay, I'm going to toss that. Okay, and then to give it a nice, pretty finish, we're going to take some of the fennel fronds, which are the green leafy part of the fennel that most people just throw away. I'm going to give this a taste. Okay, and then finally we're going to add a little bit of white rice vinegar, which is very, it has a touch of sweetness to it. Give that one more taste. That vinegar really kicked it up.
This dish starts with lots of different colors, but after a good toss, it'll all be pink. And garnish with some of those fennel fronds and some walnuts, and there you go. EarthEats.org. The hardest part of starting a new food business should be perfecting the secret recipe. For many aspiring cooks, though, the tough times come when searching for a space to legally make and sell their food. Commercial kitchen space with stainless steel counters and industrial appliances can be hard to come by. But as Harvest Public Media's Luke Runyon reports, one tech startup is trying to fix that.
Kathy Lee meticulously pours strawberry rhubarb jam into small mason jars. The jam is steaming just off the stove.
Super hot.
Yeah, it looks like it.
Super hot.
These jars will be sealed and shipped off to vendors in Colorado, Nebraska, and Illinois. Lee makes small batch jams and preserves, like strawberry cinnamon and blueberry balsamic, using local produce, sometimes even gleaned from neighborhood trees and backyard bushes.
So today it's rhubarb I had picked months ago
frozen and defrosted in here, and then organic strawberries I bought from the supermarket.
The kitchen we're in? Lee doesn't own it. In fact, she's only here a few hours every month, and those preserves are cooking right next to a pizza oven.
Not making pizza, I make jam.
We're at a pizza shop in Denver's Washington Park neighborhood. See, if Lee wants to make big batches of jam to sell legally, food safety rules say she needs a commercial kitchen.
If I don't have a space to cook, my business is effectively done.
Ever since starting her jam company, called Modern Gingham, she's been bouncing around commercial kitchen spaces. Building her own space was out of the question, way too expensive. Her first spot was in a nearby restaurant. She outgrew that space quickly. The next few stops were in shared commissary kitchens, which tended to be inflexible, expensive, and overburdened with rules.
The hardest part of running a business should be selling what you make, not the brick and mortar that you're working out of, I think. I mean, maybe that's a naive perspective, but it's been the most frustrating process.
And what's frustrating for one person is a business opportunity for another.
My name is Ashley Colpart, and I'm the founder of The Food Corridor.
There are commercial kitchens all over the place, in restaurants, churches, community centers, schools, all of which sit empty at some point during the day. Colpart says that's a wasted opportunity. She and her app, The Food Corridor, essentially act as an online matchmaker between the owner of a commercial kitchen and an entrepreneur who wants to rent it. Before she came along, Craigslist was the best online option to find a space.
And so there were all these kind of under-the-radar ways that people were accessing commercial kitchen space to produce their goods. And I thought, why not make the invisible visible by creating the marketplace?
Think of it as the Airbnb of commercial kitchens. If the sharing economy has revolutionized how we travel, why can't it do the same for the local food movement?
People really love to focus on farmers because it's sexy, and they like to focus on chefs because it's sexy.
Local food distributors and commercial kitchen access? Not as sexy, but still vitally important to give food entrepreneurs a real opportunity to grow a business, Colpart says. Back at Basil Docks, the pizza shop in Denver, owner Mike Miller says it's not just jam maker Kathy Lee who's winning in this situation. He gets some extra cash from rent.
We're in operation from 4:30 p.m. to 9 p.m. 7 days a week. So the pizza shop sits empty for essentially 19 hours a day.
Miller says since he's established, he might as well give back. He wants to see the local food movement thrive in his own neighborhood.
The barrier to entry in the food industry is very, very, I don't want to say cost prohibitive, but it's an uphill struggle.
And sometimes it's the little things, like opening up the doors to your pizza shop, that can make or break a new business. Luke Runyon, Harvest Public Media.
More at harvestpublicmedia.org.
Corbin Morwick has worked in cafeterias and chain restaurants. He's been a manager and a line cook. He's been second in command at fine dining restaurants. He needed all of those experiences to prepare him for his current job as the executive chef of One World Catering.
Well, come on back. It's not so hot today, luckily.
Catering is fast-paced. It requires a lot of planning and problem-solving, and it's different every day. But Morwick says these rules of the kitchen are always the same. First, clean and sanitize everything.
You know, we're sending food out to large groups, and if any of our dishes is contaminated in any way, then we can make a lot of people sick. So we take that extremely seriously.
He keeps a sharpening steel handy to make sure his knives are sharp.
A dull knife doesn't do the job it's supposed to do. It kind of mashes through the food instead of slicing or cutting through it. And it's harder to cut yourself with a sharp knife than it is with a dull knife.
Get everything assembled.
So get all your mixing bowls together, your measuring spoons and cups. Find all the ingredients that you're going to be needing.
and then read the whole recipe, method and all, before you start cooking.
A lot of times I'll see young cooks will just look at an ingredient list and then start throwing things together, and I'm like, wait, you have to read the procedure, not just the ingredient list.
It's especially important for a caterer or anyone making a huge meal to also make an action plan.
So that way we figure out what to start cooking when, and so that they all kind of finish up at the same time.
That's Thanksgiving,
yeah,
right?
True.
And then the fun one, taste everything.
This way you train your tongue to know what it's supposed to taste like, and just from repeated tastings and tasting of whatever it is you're making, that way it just kind of gets ingrained in your brain, that what that flavor is and what it's supposed to taste like.
Here's a new addition to the One World menu. It's a cucumber tomato salad in a yogurt sauce. Morwick says it caters well, which means he can make it ahead and the quality doesn't suffer if it has to sit for a bit.
All right, so got some nice English cucumbers. They're long and skinny, and they have fewer seeds than a traditional one. Take some strips of the peel off, but leaving about half of it intact. And that's just a visual effect. And I like a little bit of the texture of the skin. Then we'll split the cucumbers in half lengthwise, scraping down the center to remove the seeds. So now that I've scooped the seeds, I'm just going to slice these crosswise. Now we have some nice tomato. I'm just going to kind of chunk those up. Okay, now we're going to take a red onion. Certain times of year, the onions are just almost unbearably strong. So what I like to do is just to cut my onion and then rinse it under cold water, and that takes some of the harshness out. Kind of break apart the onion segments a little to get some of the juice out from between. Okay, so now onto our little dressing. And this is just a real simple yogurt dressing. A little lemon juice, some honey, a little curry powder, and then some freshly minced parsley, cilantro, and dill. Just give it a nice easy stir. Try to get everything coated with that yogurt dressing. And you can definitely smell the fresh herbs as well. I think the dill is probably the most prominent.
Quick and tasty and very colorful. Check out Corbin Morwick's recipe at eartheats.org. And in case you missed it, a couple weeks ago we visited the new One World Commissary and Kitchen Share facility. That's an Indiana version of what we heard Luke Runyon talking about in Colorado earlier on our program. Find our version in the podcast archives. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Urgent Foods, a locally owned food truck offering gourmet choices for all lifestyles, tastes, and diets. From gluten-free to kosher and halal. Food for everyone, everywhere. Full menu and truck location available at urgentfoods.com. And from Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington, independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Thanks for being here. I'm Annie Corrigan. See you next time.